This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
I'm a loser of all the love I have won or have lost. There is one love I should never have crossed. She was a girl in a million, my friend. I should have known she would win in the end. I'm a loser, and I lost someone who needs me. I'm a loser, and I'm not what I appear to be. Although I laugh and I act like a clown, behind this mask I am wearing a frown. My tears are falling like rain from the sky. Is it for her or myself that I cry? I'm a loser, and I lost someone who's near to me. I'm a loser, and I'm not what I appear to be.
Oh yeah, a little bit of the Beatles. Do you think that's what Liz Cheney is feeling right now? A little bit of that song? I'm a loser? Well, good morning anyway, and welcome to Freedom Works, the Paul Molloy Show. I am Paul Molloy, and along with my buddy Big Ed Davis, he's not a loser, he's a big-time winner here. We thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday, August 17th, as the month rolls along. We have a busy show. In a few minutes, Adam Weinstein, of the Quincy Institute will be here. We're going to talk about the one-year anniversary of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. Was it the right thing to do? We will find out what Adam thinks. So stay tuned for that in a few minutes. And we mentioned Liz Cheney. She goes down to defeat last night in Wyoming, much to the delight of Donald Trump. We're going to take a look at that. Meanwhile, the Donald says, open the affidavit on that raid on his Florida home. And that's just what a judge is going to consider. We're going to take a look at that and talk about it as well. And why is restaurant business booming in the red states right now while it is dying in the blue ones? Why? We're going to take a look at that too. And a good one in our ultimate top 10. We are going to give you the top 10 lightest presidents. We're not talking about brain power. We're talking about weight. Lightest presidents. So stay tuned for that. By the way, don't forget to listen to Senior Voice America. They're on before our show. In fact, they're on Monday through Friday, 8 to 10 a.m. here on the Tantalk Radio Network. Tim Bryce and company. Great show. Well worth listening to. So, I'm watching Liz Cheney last night. She conceded rather quickly. I guess everybody knew she was going to lose. And it was just a matter of how much. Why are you smiling, Ed? Are you excited that she lost? Or
you're acting like it was close. I mean, 40 points is not close. If that were me,
was it 40?
I would have introduced her just like this, ladies and gentlemen, Liz Cheney.
Oh my God! Well, she gave, I guess you could call it, a Lincoln-esque speech last night. Not that it was a great speech, it's just she invoked Abraham Lincoln, yeah, and kind of compared herself to Lincoln. And she did kind of tease people with the idea that she's thinking about running for president.
She said she's going to continue to fight and do whatever she can possibly do to make sure that Donald Trump goes nowhere near the White House, which goes to show you that's what she was focused on. She didn't care about what was going on in Wyoming or anything. She had blinders on. Now, either she's a little sweet on Donald or something, that she can't get him off her mind or what, I don't know. But
yeah, and you know, in all of this, we don't even, it's hard for people to even know the name of the person that beat her. But her name is Harriet Hagman. And she won, I think you said, by about 40 points. Well, that's pretty good. But they're all focusing on Liz Cheney. Poor Harriet. People barely know who she is, right? So Liz Cheney has unveiled her next move. It's going to be launching a new organization with the idea of keeping Trump from ever getting near the White House again, like you said. The name of the group, maybe you'll want to join, Ed. It's called The Great Task, and it gets its name from a phrase in the Gettysburg Address. And as we said, Cheney invoked Abe Lincoln in calling for the Republican Party to go back to its roots. Now, I can't see how she's ever going to get herself anywhere close to the White House, other than if there's some sort of a tourist group that's going through.
I think she's burned in Republican people's minds is that woman that sat there for the July 6th mm-hmm. show, dog and pony show, and just rambling on.
Mm-hmm. How effective do you think she might be with the January 6th committee? She's kind of a lame duck now.
Yeah, who really cares? I mean, what's come out of that now? Nothing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that nothing there. So let's go down to Mar-a-Lago stir things up there. Nothing's come out of there. Yep. What's next?
Right.
I understand he's going to be arrested this week.
Trump?
Yes.
Ah.
Because they found in some of the bylaws that no ex-president could ever wear a blue suit on a Wednesday, and they caught him in a blue suit on a Wednesday.
Well, that's enough.
He's going to be arrested for that.
Well, I'd give him about 10 years for that one. Yeah.
They're going to find something.
Come on. We got to, you know.
Eating corn on a Wednesday. Who knows? They're going to find something.
Now, that's something we're going to talk about a little bit later is whether or not there's anything going on with that affidavit and there's anything inside of it. I think either the Democrats or, I should say, the FBI in this case should Fisher cut bait with that. They got to give some sort of information. And like Lindsey Graham said, all right, present it to us in a closed-door session. If you want to, if you're claiming that there's information in there that we've got to keep from the public, we want a joint committee of some sort, you know, and he could be a part of it. Present it to us. We'll take a look at it, you know. But they don't seem to, the Justice Department doesn't seem to want to do that right now.
And with the two impeachments, the January 6th and this, can we see what the tab is running on that now, money-wise?
Yeah, they're beating a dead
and
horse.
You've come
How
up
much
with
does
nothing.
It cost to continue beating a dead horse? Yeah. No, it's crazy. It really is. Here's something that kind of went under the wire because of the primary elections yesterday. President Biden signed that Inflation Reduction Act. He actually broke away from his, what is he doing, a month-long vacation? He broke away for a while just to go and sign this bill into law. He says that the American people won and the special interest lost. Oh, I guess we should be excited about that, Ed. The American people won when he signed the Inflation Reduction Act. He's been in South Carolina on an island there, Kiowa Island. Sounds like a nice place.
Well, he's learned his lesson. He's riding a bike on a beach now, which softens the blow.
Yeah, now if he falls on his head, it'll be in
just,
the sand.
Yeah, that's a little sand in
his
bike.
It'll be all right. He says this law will, quote, deliver results for the American people. Yes, it certainly will. Going to have more IRS agents tracking you. There'll be a lot of results there. He says with this law, the American people won and the special interests lost. This administration began amid a dark time in America, very dark time. A once-in-a-century pandemic, devastating joblessness, clear and present threats to democracy and the rule of law. Doubts about America's future itself. And yet we've not wavered. We've not flinched. We've not given in. Can you believe that he's talking that nonsense? There's not a person around him within earshot that believes a word of what he's saying. And those are the people that are in his administration, and they don't believe what he's saying. He says, we did not tear down, we built up. We did not look back, we looked forward. And today, he said, today offers further proof that the soul of America is vibrant. The future of America is bright. And the promise of America is real and just beginning. All right. I wonder who wrote that. And I wonder how many pills whoever wrote that was imbibing. Because it sounds like he unearthed the Holy Grail or something like that. I don't think they're, this is This is something that's not going to do a doggone thing to inflation.
No, and then Joe Manchin, of course, used the politics playbook to the T by telling his constituents one thing, which was a lie, and then after it's signed, oh, by the way, this is not going to help anybody. The prescription drug, that doesn't come into effect till 2026.
Nobody's going to see anything from this thing. I mean, you're not going to see any reduction in inflation. All we're going to do is spend more money, and actually what we're doing really is borrowing or creating more money. That's what we're doing. Okay, anyway, time to take our break, because when we come back, we're going to talk about the one-year anniversary of the Afghanistan withdrawal with Adam Weinstein from the Quincy Institute.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Listen to the latest pet trends with benefits on The Pet Buzz every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Join pet trendologist Charlotte Reed and veterinarian Dr. Michael Fleck as they talk all things pets, from animal health and wellness, money-saving tips, celebrity gossip, breaking news, and more. Their expert guests are in the know and in the now. To learn more about this unique program and its hosts, tune into the show on the Tantalk Radio Network.
Caregivers find the support they need on Connecting Caregivers Radio with Linda Burhans, the gal who cares for the caregiver. Heard every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., Linda and her caring and knowledgeable guests will bring you education, information, and resources, as well as a shoulder for caregivers. That's Connecting Caregivers Radio with Linda Burhans, the gal who cares for the caregiver, where you can find help and hope every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, we're back on our Wednesday, and we thank you so very much for being with us. And we're delighted to have Adam Weinstein join us. He is a research fellow with the Quincy Institute, and he's a veteran of the Afghanistan war. And we're going to talk about the one-year anniversary. I guess it was Monday, technically. Of the withdrawal, that we, you know, Adam, we all remember the way we got out of Afghanistan. It's left a very sour, bitter taste, by and large, in the mouths of Americans. Do you think we did it the right way?
Well, I definitely think it was the right decision to leave, because it was a costly war that wasn't serving U.S. interests. I think the execution of the withdrawal itself could have been handled differently. My biggest criticism was not getting the interpreters who had assisted U.S. troops over the years out ahead of the withdrawal.
Well, as a matter of fact, did we not take out military before we took out civilians?
Well, that was an issue, that we closed some of these provincial bases before we got some of these folks out, and so it basically became impossible for them to get to Kabul.
I just can't believe the way they did it. It almost seemed like it was intentionally done bad. I mean, we go to the airport that is the least secure. We had another airport there that we could have used to withdraw people. We decided to not use that airport. We left all of that equipment of ours there, I guess, for the Taliban to use. They're probably still using some of it. I don't know. How many people were killed in that explosion? There were 13 Americans and another 35 or 40 people that were killed. I mean, everything seemed to go wrong. In fact, Biden's numbers started to implode right after that. They've never really come back.
Yeah, I think there's many different factors that led to those numbers, but so far as the ISIS attack, there were 13 U.S. service members killed and 170 Afghans killed. I think the issue is no part of this war over the last 20 years was really handled competently, and so I'm not sure why we think the withdrawal would have been handled competently. The problem was that Afghanistan was always an afterthought for whoever was the president at the time, and that continued up until the withdrawal. In fact, that's one of the reasons I supported the withdrawal. I thought we're not doing this the right way because it's not in our interest. By doing this, I mean the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get out of there.
Yeah, I think most people agree with you. I think most people did not want us to stay in Afghanistan. Well, we were there 20 years, and we basically accomplished nothing. And we didn't actually get the Afghan people to fight on our behalf. You know, if you can't get the people of the country to fight on your behalf, you're not going to win anyway. Look at Ukraine. The Russians move in there, and they're having all kinds of trouble with the Ukrainians, much more than they probably figured they would. But that's because the Ukrainians were fighting and uniting against them. When we went into Afghanistan, allegedly to go after the terrorists, we didn't really get the sympathy, I don't think, of the Afghanistan people. Your thought on that?
I think there's truth to that. Look, if you look at Ukraine, I think Ukrainians are much more united. They feel like they're defending their country. And I think if you look at Afghanistan, there were many divisions. People didn't have a strong sense of national pride at times, and they didn't have a competent leadership. I mean, whereas, in Ukraine, it's a bit different. So I think that's why we see this. I think plenty of Afghans fought, bravely. The problem was that the society overall was not very united.
Right, right. Now we're looking back after a year. We're trying to figure out how we should handle Afghanistan. And you mentioned that we need to continue to be involved with Afghanistan, that we have critical interests there. But you say that we should not recognize the Taliban government until they demonstrate a commitment to their responsibilities and respect for basic human rights. Well, Adam, they don't have any, the respect for human rights is never going to show up. Look how they treat women. Do you honestly think that the Taliban are one day going to wake up and have respect for human rights?
No, I'm not that naive, but I think it's worth repeating. There's some values that are worth repeating, even if we know that it's probably not going to come into fruition. It's worth having the message out there. I think what's most important to U.S. policymakers right now is that the Taliban don't allow al-Qaeda to operate from their soil. Obviously, they are allowing them because the head of al-Qaeda was just killed in the interior minister's house or a house owned by the interior minister. But, the point is, there's not much we get from completely disengaging. I'm a believer in talking to our enemies. I think it's important. It doesn't mean that we have a naive view of our enemies or that we trust our enemies, but I think icing them out and going about things that way, it hasn't worked in the past.
Yeah, that makes some sense. We're talking with Adam Weinstein. He is not only a research fellow with the Quincy Institute, he's a war veteran from Afghanistan. Adam, do you mind talking a little bit about your experience in Afghanistan?
Sure. I mean, I don't think my experience was that remarkable, but I was a U.S. Marine. I served in a Ruzgan province, which was a Taliban stronghold. I was actually attached to the Australian 2 Commando Regiment, which was there essentially the Australian Special Forces. And my unit's job was to coordinate close air support. So you think of somebody calling in airstrikes on behalf of the soldiers who were next to us, who were Australian by and large. So that's what we did. And at the time, I truly believed in the fight we were fighting. I'm proud of serving in Afghanistan and fighting the Taliban. But the reality is that after 20 years, we had to read the writing on the wall. And unless we were going to stay there for decades and decades, it made sense to leave. And so that's why I had a change of heart.
Sure. Well, first of all, we salute you for going there and doing what you did. But it's such a mess there. It seems like there used to be a time when America, if they got involved in something, they were going to win it. It seemed like it started to lose that kind of feeling maybe after World War II. And for a long time now, we were involved in Korea. We end up in a stalemate there. The things in Iran. Obviously, the Vietnam War was another one where we kind of left with our tail between our legs, you might say. Afghanistan, the same way. We seem to have lost, I don't know, perhaps it's the way we look at war now. The resolve to win. Do you get that feeling that maybe the resolve to win is no longer there with us?
I'm not sure it's resolve to win so much as we get involved in wars that we just don't care about the outcomes that much.
That's what I mean. We didn't have a resolve to win it.
I guess we're saying, but see, that's the problem with, we don't prioritize which wars to get involved in and which wars not to get involved in. I'll zoom out a little more. I've been to about 35 countries, and around the entire world, people still express an awe about America. No matter what people back in the United States say, the world is still quite impressed with the United States, and there's many people who aspire to be Americans and dream of that. Never have they said, hey, you know what inspires me about America? The way you guys invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam. No, they talk about our skyscrapers. They talk about our freedoms. They talk about our movies. They talk about our culture. They talk about our technological advances. That's what they talk about, and that's where American greatness is rooted, not in our ability to intervene in far-flung countries and try to meddle in their internal affairs. And mm-hmm. I think that's what we have to get back to.
Well, that makes sense. And I'm glad to hear that, too, that people still remember the great things we've done. So how do we handle this? We treat the Taliban kind of, I guess, gingerly, maybe. Be careful, don't turn your back, all that kind of thing. We continue to talk with them. It's even hard to figure out who to talk with, is it? Is it not? It's sort of a ragtag. I get the idea it's a ragtag group.
Well, look, they haven't really made the transition from being insurgents to being a government. They haven't figured that out yet. So it is true. It's unclear who makes the decisions. There is the emir at the top who has the final say, but you know, you can talk to someone senior in the government and they'll say one thing on a Tuesday and another thing on a Wednesday. So it is hard to deal with them. But I still think that having some kind of communication is better than having none, as long as we recognize, hey, we can't trust them.
We also have a bunch of people that are still left there. You alluded to interpreters and a few others, but we've still got a number of people there that we would like to get out. Do you think there's a chance we can get them out?
I think there's a chance that the Taliban took a contractor hostage and they still have him. And there's some U.S. citizens who are there, although I think they might have chosen to stay. There's a bunch of interpreters who have not chosen to stay, but were left behind. I think over time we can get them out if we have the will to do it, or as you said, if we have the resolve to do it. But you can't get them out if we're not talking to the Taliban at all. Sometimes you have to talk to your enemy, and it feels dirty and it's not fun, but it's the only way to kind of fulfill our promise to these people that we've left behind.
Do you think that Biden has handled anything well regarding Afghanistan? It seemed like he wanted to make sure we got out of there by a certain date, but it didn't seem like there was anything more to it. And it certainly didn't seem like there was a lot of effort and planning into how to do it. But has Biden, in your opinion, done anything well regarding Afghanistan?
Well, look, I think his decision to leave was the right decision, and it did take some guts as a president to do that. I mean, he got a lot of criticism for it, and he did decide to stick by President Trump's deal with the Taliban, which, unfortunately, a lot of presidents rip up the foreign policy of their predecessor, and so we have no continuity, no consistency, and people think they can't trust Americans at their word. So I applaud President Biden for not ripping up the deal that Trump made and for going through with the withdrawal. But I also agree with your criticism that so far as the execution, there wasn't much planning at all. I think that's an accurate assessment. They just kind of did it as they went along, and that's why there was a lot of chaos.
You know, another thing, for the 2 years prior to Biden pulling us out, there was no American killed in Afghanistan, if I remember correctly. We had kind of reached some sort of, I don't know what you would call it, a ceasefire agreement, maybe it was, with the Taliban. We maintained troops there. We maintained the airport there and the like. But there wasn't anything going on. And I think it was about 2 years during the last 2 years of the Trump administration where we suffered no deaths, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's true. We did have a ceasefire with the Taliban, and unfortunately there were deaths during the evacuation, but that was because it became just the perfect target for a suicide bomber. And just to be clear, it wasn't the Taliban who conducted that attack. It was ISIS, and ISIS is also killing the Taliban as well. But it was an achievement that, and unfortunately, I have to give some credit. You have to give the devil its due. The Taliban upheld that part of the agreement, at least, even though they violated many other parts in not killing Americans. So it was significant. And a lot of folks in D.C. will say, hey, we got nothing out of this deal. We got nothing out of leaving. Well, what we got was U.S. service member stuff being killed. And that might not matter to elite people in Washington, but I think it matters to the everyday American.
And finally, how do you see this relationship, say, in 5 years? Are we on the right track right now with the way the Biden administration is dealing with the Taliban, if at all? And is it going to take another administration, perhaps, to do something a little different? How do you see the future? Do you really think we're going to make any progress with the Afghans at all?
I'm really careful about making predictions about Afghanistan because Afghanistan always surprises you. I think Biden is being really cautious, but I see a little bit of progress here and there. There's going to be some slow progress. So you have to give him credit. He killed the number one al-Qaeda leader, so they were able to do that while still talking to the Taliban. But I think the progress is going to be really slow, and I think that's going to be true regardless of who's in the White House.
Indeed. Well, Adam, thank you so very much for coming on and talking a little bit about the Afghanistan war 1 year later. And again, our salute to you for your service in that war. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. All right, we're going to take our break, and when we come back, among other things, we're going to talk about Donald Trump, who says open the affidavit on that raid on his Florida home, and why is restaurant business booming in red states like Florida and dying in blue states like New York? We're going to take a look.
Do you remember?
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, this is Steve Vacaris, psychologist and host of the Chapters Wrap Live. Each live show will bring on top-notch guests from the nonprofit world. We are the advocacy show that provides a platform for other advocates. So please tune in on your drive home from work to share your voice. The Chapters Wrap, where unity and diversity meet one chapter at a time.
Listen to Kicking Unhealthy Relationships to the Curb at 5, Voices for Change at 6, Reach Out with Ray and Steve at 7, and the Chapters Wrap at 8, Wednesdays, here on the Tantalk Radio Network.
What's the buzz in Tampa Bay? Senior Voice America Radio, a unique morning variety program delivering the latest commentary on politics by host and political analyst Tim Bryce and the up-to-minute happenings of Wall Street. Beyond politics and finance, they scale the scholar's rampart by including topics on religion and nutrition with thought-provoking guests and interviews. Tune in every weekday from 8 to 10 a.m. on this Tan Talk station. Senior Voice America, serving our nation's seasoned citizens for over four decades.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, we are back on Freedom Works on a Wednesday. We thank you very much for listening to us. So, here's the rub. The judge who approved the warrant for the raid on Mar-a-Lago, Trump's home, is also the one that's going to determine whether or not they unseal the affidavit tomorrow. He's going to hold a hearing on a motion to unseal it. And his name is Judge Bruce Reinhart, by the way. He's no Trump fan. He's a Florida judge, federal judge here. The Justice Department says, we don't want you to open the affidavit. There's all kinds of things in there that if it's publicized, it's going to ruin any grand jury hearing, and we don't want to give away top secrets and this and that, the other thing. That, in other words, it would compromise the investigation. Well, Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, says, all right, then let's have a closed hearing. All right, let's have a closed hearing. Let's take a look at what it is in the affidavit so that we can at least have some idea if you've got something there. Or are you just in there and there's nothing in there except a bag of popcorn? You know? So why is the Justice Department so much against all of this? Well, they say If disclosed, the affidavit would serve as a roadmap to the government's ongoing investigation, providing specific details about its direction and likely course in a manner that is highly likely to compromise future investigative steps. In other words, the less you know, the better it is for us. We don't want you to know what we're doing. We took a huge basket into the Trump's home. We collected everything that we could. We swept the place clean, and we're going to go back and we're going to go through it, and there's got to be something in there, just something in there that we can pin on them. Why don't they just come out and say that? And everybody will believe it because it's true, you know? It's very, 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 I don't think anybody buys this thing about
no.
Oh, we went in there looking for something specific. I don't think they did.
I think they went in there looking for something to find.
Yeah, for anything.
Hoping, there might have, supposedly there was a whistleblower, and maybe this whistleblower said, oh, there might be some other good stuff in there, and this and that, and you might be able to grab onto. And nothing. Now, listen, if they had anything.
They were talking about the nuclear codes at one point.
Oh, yeah. If they had anything, they would be parading it down Pennsylvania Avenue right now. If they had anything.
And the other thing is, if they don't release the affidavit, that allows the Justice Department to leak at its pleasure. And you know what they're going to leak. They're going to leak anything that's titillating and makes it look like Trump did something wrong.
I
got to
tell you, if this was Barack Obama, the race card would have been played a long time ago. This is just one after another. We used to joke that when he was in office, he probably used to wake up in the morning and his chief of staff, he'd look at him and say, what am I accused of today?
Trump.
Yeah, Trump. It's probably still going on right now. He probably wakes up Melania, what am I doing wrong? I mean, when you've got to tell the public, we found an empty safe with nothing in it. We've gone through Melania's clothing and found nothing. There was a meme on Facebook, a funny thing, that the FBI went through Melania's clothes and they did find clothing that was appropriate for Dr. Jill to wear, Dr. Jill Biden.
Oh, so she'll be wearing some of Melania's fashions.
They found some classy stuff.
The hand-me-downs,
they found some classy stuff.
There we go. Are they about the same size? I'm trying to think. Melania is actually fairly tall.
Yeah.
I think Dr. Biden won't be able to, you know, in other words, no, I don't think so. Anyway, Trump wants the release of the affidavit. He said the whole thing. And he's also asking for this federal judge to recuse himself from going any further on it. He wants to have another judge take a look. Here's his words. In the interest of transparency, this is Trump, I call for the immediate release of the completely unredacted affidavit pertaining to this horrible and shocking break-in. Also, the judge on this case should recuse. So there you go. Right now, you're getting a lot of sympathy for Donald Trump. And I think it's backfiring. If the Democrats had or Biden had anything to do with this, it's backfiring on them. And we'll see. Maybe they got something. We can't say. We don't know 100%, but it doesn't look like they do.
I mean, listen, the Democrats have not been able to hold their wad for some time now. Because you look at the January 6th thing. We went from we've got this. Now, we've got a whistleblower. We've got a secret witness. Blah. Nothing.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there is somebody like in the Secret Service or somebody that's on staff that all of a sudden started feeding information to the Justice Department?
I think the Secret Service has probably had enough of this. Seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, you keep coming up with these things and these allegations, and nothing has come out of it. I mean, you go on TV shows and you have radio shows where you bash the guy and say, he's done this, he's done this, and nothing, nothing you can bring to the table of hard evidence other than hearsay.
You know, if the Democrats didn't have a Trump to beat, they'd have to invent something like a Trump to beat on.
I don't know.
Think about it.
This is ridiculous.
Think about it. What else can they talk about? Are they going to talk about prices, economic situation, the border? Are they going to talk? Well, what are they going to talk about that's
Paul,
positive?
That's all part of it. It's deflection.
So they can talk about him.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
For one thing, you got to remember, these people, whether they're doing radio or TV shows, they're deathly afraid of Donald Trump running again and getting back in. They're deathly afraid of that.
Yeah. And then there's the other side that says, well, if we can get him to run again, we have a better chance of winning than if somebody like DeSantis ran.
And
because there's a lot of anti-Trumpers out there, and he will get people to the polls, just like this last election, that are going to vote against him. So I don't know about that.
And if you put Trump, if Trump does get in there for 4 years, then looky-ho, you've got DeSantis after that. The Democrats are really in trouble for the next 12 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be. We'll see. All right. Now, I found this to be a very interesting story, and it has to do with going to restaurants. Did you know that in places like here in Florida and here in Tampa Bay, that the restaurant businesses are doing fairly well right now?
When they can find the workers.
True. But I'm talking about patrons.
Sure.
It says here, it's famine or feast for American restaurants right now. In deep blue cities that have faced both COVID restrictions that are somewhat excessive in the minds of many, plus the protests, right, that were going on in 2020, they are starving for diners, according to global data. The same source shows that Sunbelt boomtowns in Florida, Texas, and Arizona are busier than ever and enjoying a massive surge in restaurant business this year. It says here the divide between the two is startling. As an example, the number of daily diners in Minneapolis is down an average of 54% in July. 54%. So that's less than half the number of people eating out compared with July 2019.
Now these places that are struggling, have they lifted all of the COVID restrictions? I mean, everything. I mean, you remember we went in phases. We had the mask. There was only you were allowed to sit 6 feet apart or whatever, and the dining room was shrunk down to 25%. I mean, is it back open to 100%? Are no masks required? I mean, is it?
I think there are some that still require masks,
and that's turning people off.
I think it is. I think it is. It may say in here, but I don't think it says the number of restaurants that are still enforcing the mask mandate. But it says here, Florida has four of the top six surging cities in America, with the average number of people dining out in Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Naples, and Tampa up nearly 30% from the beginning of the pandemic, July 2019. So it's just a very interesting piece of data. Let's see here. So but they mentioned in the story that it's not just the pandemic. It's the idea of going downtown to some of these cities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's be honest. Would you go into Chicago would you not think if you were going to go down in the city of Chicago, you might consider a little bit being worried about some violence, maybe New York,
exactly.
Or maybe you know what I mean.
When you're talking
about that, also discourages you,
right?
From
when
out.
You're talking about some of those places like New York and Chicago, it's more than just masks and COVID you're worrying about. You're worrying about your life,
exactly.
We're crying out
so
loud.
So there's a combination, and that's what they're saying in here. That those are the two factors that are influencing this turnout.
And in some places,
we don't seem to have that. It's apparently in Tampa Bay. Although there are places in Tampa I wouldn't want to go at night.
But we're ahead
but
of
we
the
don't
curve.
Worry about it as much here.
We got to remember we're ahead of the process because we've been open. People have been out. They've been making money and stuff like that. The people in some of these other stuff where they've been locked down, They have not been able to get out. They have not been working. And their finances are probably not as good as the people that are down here.
Oh, that's true.
And that could be preventing them from going out and spending money.
Yeah, that's another thing. It says here, Minneapolis, going back to them, enacted 2 years of onerous executive order lockdown policies starting in March 2020. The mandate included two statewide periods of extended takeout-only options for restaurants. You know, there's got to be a lot of restaurants that just couldn't last also when you're doing that to them. They just couldn't afford to continue to operate their business. I wonder how many actually closed down. So that the number of actual restaurants available in some of these cities is not as high as it used to be either.
No.
So you got all of that going on.
And when you talk about Minneapolis, I mean, that might as well be in a different country, what's going on there.
Yeah, they have.
I mean, there's so many other things.
Remember all that
trouble
they had?
Yeah. You've got crime. Now I saw the thing on the report of the teachers that they're going to fire teachers that are white first over teachers that are black. Which you'll get into, but I mean, Minneapolis has got so many problems.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems. In fact, let's do this. We got a break coming up anyway. Let's take our break. We will talk about that that situation with firing whites first when it comes to teachers. We'll talk about that when we come back. Stay tuned.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer, inventor? Do you have questions about your intellectual property rights? Well, tune in every Tuesday and Thursday morning at 11 o'clock for Joy on Paper. Once a month, I will have a special guest, the writer's legal eagle, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, who can answer your questions. Protect your valuable work. Email me your questions to patsy.radio@gmail.com and then listen in every Tuesday and Thursday at 11 a.m. right here on Tampa Bay's Tantalk Radio Network. That's patsy.radio@gmail.com.
Hey, you new to the area or just want to know about the best hidden gems and upcoming events? Stay tuned. Be Local Buzz with Devin takes you to these places, introduces you to the best businesses, and tells you about upcoming buzz. Preset your radio to Tan Talk 1340 AM or 106.1 FM every Thursday from 4 to 5. That is the Be Local Buzz with Devin on Tan Talk 1340 AM and 106 FM every Thursday from 4 to 5. Looking forward to speaking with you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, we're back for the final segment of Freedom Works on a Wednesday. By the way, we're here Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on WTAN, the Tantalk Network. However, we are also making available to you the fact that we do our shows and they are put by Ed on podcast, which means you can go to our website, ourfreedomworks.com, and you can listen to our show at your leisure. At your leisure. Ed puts all of them on podcast. He puts the latest ones at the top. So you get there and click on the podcast button, and you'll see who the guest is for each show. You'll see the top 10, thanks to Ed. Bless him. And away you go. You can listen to our show two or three or four times in a row. You can make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and sit there and listen. It's very nutritious. Ourfreedomworks.com. All right, Ed, you talked about the situation in Minneapolis with the teachers. An agreement between the teachers union there and the public schools stipulates white teachers will be laid off before teachers of color, regardless of seniority. Now that's really bright. Now we're gonna decide because of the color we're gonna let you go first. What kind of nonsense is that? That immediately, right away, a red flag comes up. You're violating civil rights right there.
So my understanding is their reasoning is because of what happened in the past that this is kind of like payback.
So yeah, in other words,
to fight, racism, or what are we looking for here?
Discrimination.
To fight discrimination, we're going to use discrimination.
Right. Right. Now, our buddy Jonathan Butcher, remember him? He's a Heritage Foundation expert. He's been on our show. He said that the first thing is that this contract violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Protection Clause under the U.S. Constitution. It certainly does. You're not going to get anywhere with this idea. He says this is political posturing, and it's not dealing with the most important issue, helping students with their math and their reading. Exactly.
Because,
boy, oh boy.
Well, what they're saying is a white kid cannot learn from a black teacher and vice versa. A black kid cannot learn from a white teacher, and they should learn from their own race. Is that...
I tell you,
you can't get any more racist than that, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Now, historically, teacher furloughs and layoffs have been done on a first-in, last-out basis, right? If you're just on board and all of a sudden they have to cut back on teachers, you knew you were going to be the first one to go out, too, because you barely found your own classroom and they got to start laying people off. You're going to go, you know? And that made a little bit more sense.
What about their hiring? If they're hiring, is there a limit on that? Is there a race color on that, on their hiring?
They better not be.
Did they hire back?
Look, if they're willing to get rid of white teachers first, I would think that they would have no problem deciding that they would go after black teachers first to hire again. I mean,
can you imagine a business that hangs a sign out on the sidewalk that says hiring blacks only?
Yeah.
Or hiring whites
right.
only?
Oh, yeah.
Why don't we
work.
Just go back to the 50s again?
Can you imagine all of the people screaming if these teachers that were being laid off were only black? We're going to lay off the black teachers first and we're going to keep the white teachers, you know. No. It doesn't work either way.
And you got to remember, Minnesota was number one in defunding the police, too.
Yeah.
So, now, going on there.
I want to switch horses a little bit here and actually give us some kind of good news, Ed. I don't know if you heard about this. Did you know there may be a nasal spray that can prevent Alzheimer's disease and stop epileptic seizures?
I heard something about
that.
It's in trials or something.
There's a new nasal spray that may hold the key to saving people from both epilepsy and Alzheimer's. The Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University says this spray uses a novel peptide that boosts the brain's ability to prevent seizures and protect neurons. Specifically, the team developed this peptide. It shows the ability to tamp down uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain. It's a common problem after a traumatic brain injury or a stroke, as well as a symptom affecting more than half of all Alzheimer's patients. So it sort of calms the brain, this peptide, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I sure hope this thing is for real. Let's see here. They say this is a powerful receptor to then silence the neurons. This naturally calming relationship also blocks electrical activity that can cause the irregular heartbeat. All good news. Let's keep our fingers crossed. All right. Before we get to our top 10, which are the lightest presidents, and I want to see Ed, I want to see if you can come up with number one. But anyway. I understand that the Rays are smacking the Yankees around. Tampa Bay, our beloved Tampa Bay Rays, the Yankees. I thought the Yankees were the best team in the Major League.
There's a lot of booing in the Bronx these last couple of nights.
I can imagine.
The Rays have so far, and it's not even been close. Though. The other night it was 7-0. Last night I believe it was 3-1, and the Yankees had gone 20, I think it was either 22 or 24 innings without scoring a run.
Wow. The magnificent Bronx Bombers.
And I believe they now dropped...
That's almost three full games.
11 of 13.
Have they?
Yeah.
What's going on? Do you know?
They've got a couple of guys hurt. And, you know, when they were on that smashing, you know, run, they were benefiting from not having injuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've seen with the Rays. Now the Rays are getting guys back in droves.
Whoa, maybe you know, we have a shot.
They're getting a lot of guys
so
back in
So we have a
rows.
Shot at making the playoffs.
And the guys that have been filling in are really starting to peak. Now you've got a problem. You got to think, who am I going to put in there now and who am I going to send down?
Right.
You know?
Wow. Well, that's
maybe it's a nice problem to have.
Yes, it is. All right. It's time for our top 10. And for those of you that follow our show, Monday we did the top 10 heaviest presidents. Ed, do you remember who the heaviest was?
Yeah.
Yeah, he remembers it's William H. Taft that was the heaviest.
I was going to say, I was looking for his name, but I can remember.
All right, good. All right, let's see if you know who the lightest president was. Are you ready? Here we go. Number 10. William Henry Harrison is number 10, 162 pounds. That's a lightweight.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Number, the next one is a three-way tie. Okay. So we'll say number 7A. John Tyler, good old Tippecanoe and Tyler too, 160 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Number 7B, good old Benjamin Harrison. We all remember what he did, right? He was also 160 pounds. All right, 7C. Well, I really do remember this guy, Jimmy Carter.
I was thinking Jimmy Carter could be somewhere to the top.
Especially now.
Yeah.
But this is when he was president, okay? He's got to weigh less than this now, but he was 160 when he was president.
He's 160 now.
Oh, no, he's less than that.
No, I'm saying age.
Oh, yes, okay, all right. Number 6. Ulysses Grant.
Mm.
I guess, you know, he was a big-time drinker. Does that mean that if you drink a lot, you keep your weight down? 156 pounds for Ulysses Grant.
Wow.
Number 5, John Adams. John Adams, our second president. 150 pounds.
150.
Wow.
Hillary's left cankle weighs more than that.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. Number 4, the guy that talked less than any other president. They used to call him Silent Cal, Calvin Coolidge.
Mm-hmm.
Calvin Coolidge weighed only 148 pounds. Maybe that's why he kept his mouth shut. He was so little that he, you know, somebody could slap him around if he got out of hand. Number 3, Franklin Pierce. You remember him, Ed? 144 pounds. Wow. What a little person he is.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Number 2. Now, this guy, I would have thought was more than this because I always thought he was kind of tall. Andrew Jackson.
No.
Andrew Jackson was not tall, but he wore that pompadour haircut.
And
it made him look taller.
Added 3 inches?
Exactly. He only weighed 140 pounds. 140! All right, Ed. Who do you think's number one lightest president? I'll also give you a big hint. He's also the shortest president.
Well,
you don't remember, we did the shortest presidents.
Can't be, because I seem to remember what I remember as a little pudgy would be Nixon.
Oh, no, not Richard Nixon. No. James Madison.
Okay.
100 pounds even. The father of our Constitution was the shortest and the lightest.
Wow.
100 pounds. I'll tell you what, his brain was pretty big. All right. Thank you so very much for listening. We will be back on Friday. In the meantime, please remember, freedom works.